Let's give a massive welcome to Daryl Tunningley.
Wow, thank you. Am I allowed to move around tonight? Like when I was speaking here on Sunday, they said, no, stand there, do not move. And I was like, okay, I can stroll a bit tonight. It's good. I'm more relaxed. It's great to be here again. I'm going to share with you some of my journey and some of my story, because Alpha played a big, big part in things turning around for me. And everyone loves a good story. Everyone loves a good chinwag. Everyone loves a good book or a good film. And because we like to get lost in something else. So I'm going to share with you some of my story. Before I share some of my story, I'm just going to share a funny story. There's some of you may have heard this before, but it's still funny. We have a visually impaired couple in our church. And we were away on an Alpha weekend. Part of the Alpha course is there's a weekend away, the Holy Spirit weekend. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant weekend. So if they're having one here, sign up for it and get yourself on it. So we're away on this weekend, and the thing that fascinated me was these two dogs went to the guide dogs. They went to the toilet on demand. On demand. I'm like, I've got two kids, 5 and 2. This is a skill, a Jedi skill I need in my life to make them go to the toilet on demand. So I was like, how does this work? And literally one click, and the dogs went for a wee. Two clicks, and they went for a, yeah. No one has that problem before I carry on clicking. Don't want to get messy. And so then I'm chatting with the guy who trains these dogs. And he's telling me about the whole process. He said, well, one of the first things we have to do, I'm training a dog now. And he said, I've got to get them used to being around crowds of people. So what I do is I get the permission from the local supermarket, which for him was Morrison's. I'm not being supported by them or anything. It's just that was the supermarket. And I said, I walk in on the supermarket and get them used to being in a busy area around crowds. I said, oh, that's brilliant. I'll let us know how you're getting on. So I'm talking to him again a few weeks later. And I said, how are you getting on with that dog? He said, oh, it's going really well up until the point it did a 2 clicks in Morrison's. I said, well, that's not so bad, is it? You tell the woman and the voice comes over the tunnel, clean up an aisle 4, and everybody's happy. He said, no, you don't understand. It's where it did the 2 clicks. So what do you mean? He said, you know them big revolving doors as you walk in? Never have to finish that. Your heads did it. Right. My story. I always get uncomfortable calling it my story. It's not really. It's God's story, and I just happen to be in it. But it kicks off. We'll start at about the age of 11. About the age of 11 is where drugs and drink became a part of my life. And I grew up in a rough area on an estate called Warwick Estate. And it was just, I'm often asked the question, why did you get involved with crime? And I said, well, it wasn't a conscious decision. I didn't go and see the careers lady at school and say, is there a course I can do in armed robbery? It was just, it was there. It was all around us. And still to this day, the police won't run on that estate after dark. The buses won't run on it after dark. If you drive through slower than 30 miles an hour, you'll lose the wheels off your car. It's just that kind of a place. When we went filming with the BBC, they did a documentary for BBC One's Inside Out. And we're back there filming, and the film crew are all there, and they're filming away, and we're doing... By the way, anything you see on TV now, I know it's a lie. Because you do the same thing like 6 times, and then they mash it all together. So I watch stuff on telly now, I think it didn't happen like that. But anyway, we're doing this filming, and this producer from BBC says, it's not that bad up here, is it? Just as he said that, 2 guys came walking past, pushing a silver cross pram with a 50-inch plasma telly in it. And they went... Hey, it's Daryl! And that was it. Then the jungle drums kicked off. Half the estate came out on motorbikes, BMXs, you name it. They all started pouring out. And this film crew were getting really twitchy because I thought, oh, the kit was going to get nicked. I said, no, you'll be all right. You'll be fine. But that's the area I grew up in. Just last week, there's a youth centre called the Addy. It's been there since I was a kid. I got banned when I was 12 from the Addy, and I'd never been back. I got an email from a youth worker at the Addy who was there when I was going to the Addy. She said, we'd love to get you back to come and talk to the kids, and I'll even lift the ban. So, bonkers. So that's where I grew up. And as the drug use progressed, and I started with weed and drinking and smoking, and it progressed on and went on from there, and it was the days of the early rave scene. Who's in their mid to late 30s and wants to confess that they were in the Whistle Posse Blow? Yeah, you were there, weren't you? White gloves, working man's jacket, here we go. And it was illegal underground raves. We used to go to one called in Doncaster called Donny Warehouse, and then there was another one called Gatecrash. We used to go to Orbit in Leeds, and there was loads of them. We used to tour around the country going to these illegal raves, Helter Skelter in Skegness. We used to go all over the place. And the drugs of choice were cocaine, ecstasy, amphetamine, LSD, and whatever we were taking, we were selling, because we figured out then we got ours free. And then it progressed on from there, and we thought, actually, if I get someone else to sell it for us, we get ours free and money, and there's less risk. So then it progressed on, and we had more people selling for us. There was sort of three of us, key people involved in this, and I'm the only one left alive. One of my mates, he was shot and killed within a week of me being locked up. It was an argument over the whole area, because I got locked up and someone else wanted to step in. My other mate, I held him while he died. I watched the life just drain out of him. And he'd overdosed. The ambulance just didn't get there in time. Me, myself, overdosed at least half a dozen times. Stabbed twice. One time, it was a sharpened screwdriver. In a gang fight, big screwdriver. And he went to stab me with it. And I sort of brushed it off. And it hit my chest plate, bounced off the bone, lodged in my shoulder socket. And with things like that, you can't go to the hospital. Because the first thing the hospital do will bring the police. So I had to take it out myself and just patch up as best I could. And I still have problems with my shoulder now. Went to do a meet up near Hull Docks about a shipment that was coming through. Saw the guy I was meeting, pulled the car over, started chatting with this guy. Heard the crack of gunfire. It's a very distinct sound. And the headrest exploded on the driver's seat and the back window went through. An inch one way and it had killed him, an inch the other way it would have killed me. I don't know who they were shooting at. I don't know if they're shooting at him. I don't know if they're shooting at me. I don't know really where the gunshot came from. I had a rough idea, but I couldn't see anybody. There was a gun in the car. Did I go Hawaii 5-0? Did I portray it like the media do? No. I filled my shorts, put it in first, and I was gone. So that's the life I find myself leading. That's the speed my life is traveling at. So when somebody asked me, do I want to get involved in an armed robbery? I didn't think twice. I was like, yeah, fine. Why not? It was an easy job. It was an in-out. They needed a driver. And this was the days before police central databases. So what we used to do was we'd cross the border from West Yorkshire into South Yorkshire. We'd nick the car in South Yorkshire and bring it back over the border, because it'd take at least a week for South Yorkshire police to even tell West Yorkshire police that there might be a nicked car in the area. So you had like this honeymoon period you could drive around in it. And I always say, I don't get kids today that get involved with crime. They make it obvious, you know, pit bulls, hoodies, la, 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 giving it all that. We would wear suits and drive Volvos to go do drug deals. You know what I mean? We're a little bit savvy with it. The kids today, they're like, look at me, I'm a criminal. And I've never really got that. I'm sure they don't all sound like that. But anyway. And the car I got, this will give my age away a little bit. Who remembers the Vauxhall Carlton GSI 3000? Who remembers that? That was a lovely car. So if you were living in the South Yorkshire area about 1997, I'm sorry, but it was a lovely car. And being a Vauxhall of that age, all you needed to nick it was a bit of scaff bar and a screwdriver. So we went and we got the car and we did the job, and the job went off without a peep. We got away clean and clear. And we thought everything would be all right. Now, we'd agreed to have no contact for a couple of weeks, so the police couldn't patch us up together. Because of that, we didn't know that one of the lads on the job actually got lifted on a separate charge. He got into an argument, bit of a fight, and he went and stanleyed someone straight across the face and got locked up. He was an addict too. Within a couple of days of being held, remanded back to police custody, questioned over and over again, you know, midnight, 5 a.m, 8 a.m, eventually he was detoxing and he cracked. And he turned Queen's evidence against the rest of us. The first we knew about it was when somebody come banging at my door selling drugs for me. He said, you've got to get on your toes, they're all coming. I said, who's coming? Initially, I was thinking, what, you mean another gang's coming down, we're going to have a bit of tussle, what's going on? He said, no, they're all at the top of your road. Armed response, dog units, Black Mariah's, they're all at the top of your road. Armed response, I wasn't too fussed about. They don't shoot you for no reason. Black Mariah crews, weren't really bothered about, but he said police dogs. Now, police dogs have an habit of chewing on things or not be chewed on, right? So you don't run from them. So I thought, right, I can't leg it now. What am I going to do? So I thought, if I can get down the back of the flats, I'll make it to my mate Joe's down the end without being seen. I'll lay low in his, then I'll go on the run when it blows over. So I managed to get out of mine, jump over a few walls, get down the back of his without being seen, got to his. The one time I needed him to be in, and it was signing on day. He weren't in. So I panicked, kicked his door through. I smashed the Yale lock as the door went in. I shut it back as best I could, but it was obvious it had been kicked through. And I'm watching through the curtains, and I saw them go up to mine. I heard the commotion as my door went through, and I saw them marching the couple of lads that were left in mine. I knew they wouldn't say anything. And as I'm watching this unfold, another load of police officers came out the flats opposite. I thought, that's weird. Where they come from? I later found out that the robbery squad had come to arrest me. I hadn't bothered to tell the drug squad, who'd had me under observation for 6 weeks, that they were coming. So the robbery squad boys are like, well, he's not here. And the drug squad lot are saying, oh, he's here somewhere, because we saw him come in and he's not come out. So he's in the area somewhere. So then they start going door to door. And as they got round to Joe's door, what did they find? A door that's been kicked in. So they pushed the door open. And I came up with this genius plan in 3 seconds flat. I'll pretend to be Joe. So they come in. Hello, police, anybody in? I jumped up acting all startled and surprised. Who are you? What are you doing in my flat? I said, oh, it's police, sir. We're looking for Daryl Tunningley. Have you seen him? I said, oh, no, he's a bad lad, him. He lives up there. You want to stay away from him? They said, we noticed that your door's damaged. I said, I know, I lost my keys. I've had to kick the door, and I'm waiting for the council to come and fix it. That's why I'm in. And they're buying it. They're actually buying the story. And as they're getting ready to go, this detective sergeant walks around the corner, pops his head around the door and goes, all right, Daryl, how are you doing? No manner of luck. And it all kicked off at that point. So where I was standing, there was a coffee table with a knife on. And they knew my reputation. They weren't taking any chances. So those boys backed right off. And then the armed response lads came in, screaming, shouting, me face down on the floor, knees in my back, cuffs on. And as they stood me up, they twisted the cuffs. So to alleviate the pressure, because it was hurting my wrist, I just flung my head back and clipped the nose of the arresting officer and bust it. That pleased them greatly, that did. Back on the floor again, more knees in, tie wraps on, picked up, chicken locked, and thrown in the back of the van. Cut a long story short. Leeds Crown Court, courtroom number 3. I'd switched my plea to guilty from not guilty to avoid a trial in the hope that the judge would think I was being a really repentant boy. Never worked. And my brief, my legal team had said, expect 10 years and up. So I thought I'd got myself ready for this. But on that day, I actually got handed down 7.5 on that day. I appealed it and got knocked down again because I got more than everybody else. But I remember him saying that. I remember him saying 7.5 years. And then I don't remember anything else. Because I was just gripping the bar and using every ounce of my strength just to stop my legs buckling out underneath me. And something snapped. Something broke inside me. I think that was the last bit of humanity. And it just went. And I thought, that's it. If I'm going to be bad, I'm going to be the best kind of bad I can possibly be. Gloves are off. There's no limits anymore. And they took me back down to the holding cells. And I flipped. And the group 4 boys came in to try and calm me down. I chased them back out of the cell. They said, look, if you calm down, we'll let you have 10 minutes with your family before we ship you back. So I calmed down enough, and they took me through to this area with a big perspex screen and a counter, and they're all on the other side, mum, dad, brother, sister, you name it, they're all there. And they're crying. And I had to do then the hardest thing I'd done up to that point, which was not cry. I couldn't. I had to let them believe everything was going to be okay. But the exact opposite was the truth. I wanted to hurt someone. So angry. Got back to the prison, HMP Doncaster, or Doncatraz, as we used to call it, because it's got a canal around it. And first morning out, I was coming down for breakfast, and on D Wing in Doncaster, there was a pool table. Two lads stood by the pool table, and I thought one of them said something directed towards me. Turned out he hadn't, but I thought he had. So I just casually walked over. Didn't even look at him, didn't say a word, picked up one of the pool balls and just smashed him around the head. And then I had him pinned on the floor and was beating him. Screws came, dragged me off, put me in the block. That one scored me 3 weeks in the block. The block in that prison meant 23, 24-hour rotation lockdown. So every second day you got an hour out in a little yard. You'd have thought that might have taught me a lesson, but it really didn't. Put me back on general population. Breakfast time again. Don't know what it was about breakfast time. I think I was just grouchy before I'd eaten. And I got as far as the servery this time, and there's a prison officer behind the servery. And I took what he said to me and the way he said it to be disrespectful. So I dragged him over the servery counter and I started beating him. And that one got me shipped out. I almost faced outside charges on that one. And I kept repeating the same behavior, so they kept moving me from prison to prison to prison to prison. Until I went down to Leicester. And for me, that was a couple of hundred miles away from anybody I knew. I wasn't going to get any visits. It was a horrible three-tier, three-story old prison. You know, with the lights go off at night, you could hear the cockroaches come out. It wasn't a nice place. I thought, I've got to do something drastic to get shipped out of here quick time. And the only thing I could think of doing was what I did next. The three-tier prisons, on the first landing, there's a safety netting. In case anything goes over, it won't hit anybody on the head on the ground floor. I was up on the threes. First morning, I walked out. The lad there on the land, I don't know who he was. I just grabbed him and threw him over the railing. He fell down three floors onto the netting. He was a bit battered, a bit bruised, and needed to change his underpants. But apart from that, he was all right. And it worked. The governor was like, get him out of my prison now. Backfired a little bit, though, because I got starred up and put on Category A. But I landed at HMP Wolds near Hull. And it was a different kind of prison, longer-term prisoners. It was quieter. There was none of that pigeon-chesting going on. And you see lads when the pigeon-chest, like the shove, 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 and then the ultimate weapons come out. Release the nipples! And it's... there was none of that going on. And I landed a job in the welding shop. It was a cushy number. You go out of your cell every day, apart from a Wednesday afternoon when they had staff training, so you had to do bang up on a Wednesday. But apart from that, you were out of your cell. And you got paid £12.50 a week, which was in prison. That was good money. That was good wages, prison wages. The ironic thing was we were making the internal gates for the prison service. So I was making the things that were keeping me in. You have no idea how many escape plans were running through my head working in that shop. So I'm minding my business and I'm welding away and there's a lad coming around the workshop with a clipboard. Wasn't unusual. There's always someone trying to get you on an anger management course, education program, something like that. And he's coming around and I'm watching him get rejected by everybody. And then he came up to me and he went, do you want to go on an alpha course? I had no idea what he was talking about. I said, well, what's an alpha course? He said, oh, it's in the chapel. As soon as he said the word chapel, I just thought, oh, great, he's a Bible basher. I said, look, get out of my face, sunshine, before I slap you. And he did. He did the best Speedy Gonzales impression I've ever seen in my life. He's on the leap, and they're gone. And I thought, no more of it. And I'm back in the workshop again the next day, and this lad's coming around with his clipboard again. And he was coming towards me, so I'm just stood there thinking, you cheeky beggar. I told you yesterday, now you're going to get a slap. So I was just waiting for this kid to get within slapping range. I was just going to turn around and dish him one. Just he was just almost there, he blurted something out. He went, you get Wednesday afternoon out of bang up and you get free coffee and you get free biscuits. I said, I'll see you on Wednesday, sunshine. It was a skive. You got out of the workshop, free coffee and free biscuits, and you didn't do your bang up. Too right I was going. I then unknowingly went and did my first evangelistic act. I rounded up all my mates in the workshop and said, come on, boys, we're all going alpha. So they were expecting half a dozen on this course, and they got 30. 30 people on this course. Arm robbers, murderers, drug dealers, you name it, they're on this course. And when I got there, I still didn't know what to expect. But when I got there, still, it was not expecting what I found. Three people running this course. Person number one, it was the vicar, chaplain. To me, with all my stereotypes of church, dog collar on, works for God, that's where he should be. That made sense. But the other two did not make sense. It was two retired nuns. How old have you got to be a retired nun? I didn't even know they did retire. It was less age concern and more mummy returns is where I'm going. You know. And if so, again, with all my stereotypes of church, if somebody said to me, you know, paint a picture of a fine Christian woman, these two girls ticked every one of my stereotype boxes. Sandals with socks and a slight mustache. I later discovered not all Christian women have the optional tash, and I married one that didn't have one. All right? I thought, what have I come to? This is not worth obnobs. Chocolate ones, maybe, but not plain ones. And so we just started giving them a hard time. We started really, really laying into them. I wasn't listening to anything they had to say. And I was just giving him the usual arguments. God doesn't exist. Even if he did, what's he ever done for me? What do you know about life and living? You've been locked in a nunnery for 900 years. You're older than Yoda. And we just gave him such a hard time. And the thing that got my attention, it wasn't what they were saying at that point, but it was how they were doing it. You see, we were being nasty. We were being borderline abusive. They could have had us on a nicking. They could have put us in the block if they wanted to. But they didn't. And they kept coming back at us with compassion and love. And that felt weird. In fact, beyond weird. For me, I was sat there and I felt dead on the inside. I honestly believed I would never have the capacity to love or feel loved ever again. So to be hit by that was like getting slapped in the face with a wrecking ball. And it stopped me dead in my tracks. And I thought, do you know what, Daryl, for once in your life, shut up and listen to somebody else. And when I did, then it started to make sense. This was week 3 of the course by now. And the topic of this particular week was, why did Jesus die? And when they asked that question, I heard it differently. The way I heard it was, why the heck would he for me? What could he possibly see in me that would be worth dying for? What could he possibly see in me that was worth redeeming? I'm sat there and I'm thinking, I'm a scumbag. You know, how many people are dead because of me? How many families have I wrecked? How many communities have I destroyed? My lasting legacy, what is there that he sees in me, that anyone sees in me, but particularly the Son of God, that he would walk along, stand in the dock and say, it's all right, mate, I'll sort this sentence out, even if it's a death sentence. And you might be sat here tonight, you might be thinking, well, I'm not as bad as you, Daryl. I haven't done the things you've done. You know, I raised my kids well. I paid my taxes. I nicked a Mars bar once from the corner shop when I was 10. But that's about it. We're kind of missing the point because it's not about that. Let me just tell you what I mean. If I had in my possession a DVD or Blu-ray, if you want to get bang up to date, but upon this disc is everything, and I mean everything, you've ever done. Even the stuff you've only done in private. On this disc is everything you've ever said. Even the things you've only said to yourself. Here's the scary one, especially for blokes. Everything you've ever thought is on that disc. Let's have a show of hands. Who'd like me to sit down with a bit of popcorn, 2 for £2 from Asda, and watch it with, oh, I don't know, your wife, your kids, your nan. You see, none of us want that stuff seen. And the freaky thing is, God has seen it all and says, I still love you. I love you anyway. But I love you too much to leave you that way. And the only way that stuff can get fixed is if I send my son to pay for it. I'm sat there thinking, why would he do that for me? He's offering me not just a clean slate, it's way more than that. He's going to take the old one and smash it, incinerate it, so there's not even a shadow of a memory of it left in existence anymore. But why would he do that? Give me a whole new slate, a whole new life. Gets to the end of the course, and they give me a Bible. I remember him saying something like, hope to see you in church on Sunday. I think I said, if there's free biscuits, I'll be there. And this Bible, it was a Wednesday night, there was nothing on the radio. I had nothing to read. So I just started thumbing through this Bible. And the thing that got my attention was, there's a book in the Old Testament called the Book of Job. Right? I know this now because I've been to Bible college. But at the time, I'd never read a Bible. And the Book of Job, it's spelled J-O-B. So if you'd never read it before and you saw a word spelled J-O-B, what would you think it said? Exactly. I thought, a funny place to find one, I'll have a read. And so I started reading the Book of Job. Find out it's a bloke called Job. And this guy, I've got engrossed in this book. He's like the Simon Cowell of the Old Testament. This guy, no high trousers, obviously, but this guy, he's got everything. He's got every car you could wish for. We just called them camels back then. But he's got every one of them. He's got wealth, status, property, you name it, he's got it. And then in this short period of time, he loses the lot. His kids are killed. He loses his wealth. He loses his health. His friends turn against him. His wife turns against him. Everything that could go wrong goes wrong. In the end, he gets it all back and then some. But through the whole process, there's one thing that won't budge. It's faith in God. In fact, he ends the whole process and he makes this statement of, I thought I knew God, but now I truly do. I thought that's mental. What was it that made him stick with his faith all the way through all those things going on? Either this guy is psychotically stubborn or he's twigged onto something I'm missing. He's figured something out that I haven't quite got yet. What made God so real to him that he would not budge? I want to know. I'm a Yorkshireman. I'm brought up to believe the proof of the pudding is in the eating. I want to know. So I sat on my bunk and I said the first real prayer I'd ever said in my life. Can't repeat it word for word. Because quite a lot of swear words in it. God speaks every language, including blue. What he's looking for is this, your heart. No right way or wrong way to shout out to God. He just wants a genuine plea. The clean version was, God, I believe. I believe everything. I believe that you died for me. I've still not quite figured out why you would, but I believe that you have. I believe that you're giving me a second chance, a new life. But I need you to prove it in me. I need you to take away the drug addiction. I need you to take away the anger, the hate, the violence, the bitterness, the resentment. And if you do that for me, I will live the rest of my life for you. And I said it with such sincerity. You didn't have many things in prison. The one thing you had they couldn't take off you was your word. And that's how I built my reputation. If I said to someone, I'm going to break your jaw, they knew it was getting done. They would get themselves shipped out, put on protection, or they're paying me off. They'd do something because they knew I was going to do it. So when I said this to God, I said it with that level of sincerity. So I expected some form of a response. You know, I've just poured my heart out to God. I wasn't asking for like a shaking cell door or a booming voice. Yes, my son. But a warm, fuzzy feeling would have done. Nothing. Flat as a pancake. So like, cheers for listening. I'm going to bed. But when I woke up the next morning, there was a series of very, very freaky events that would mark a turn for the rest of my life. Freaky event number one, always gagging for a cigarette first thing in the morning. Rolled over, same as I'd done every morning. Went to grab the cigarette, same as I did every morning. And I just couldn't. The look, the thought, the smell, everything about it made me want to be sick. And I had to get rid of it, and I just put it out my cell window. I thought, have I eaten something dodgy? Have I picked up a stomach bug? What's going on here? Sat up on my bunk and I'm looking over on my shelf and there's my tobacco and my Rizzlers and my wick lighter and the sickness came back. I couldn't stand having them near me. And I knew what I had to do and I got them and I put them out the cell window. As soon as they're gone, I started feeling a bit better. But I was still freaking out. Then the thought of my weed popped in my head. I always had enough cannabis in the cell just for a couple of spliffs. As soon as that popped in my head, it came back, but with a vengeance. I was choking on my own throat. I knew what I had to do, and I went and got my little stash out, and I put it straight out of my cell window. Whoever was on yard cleaning duty that morning must have thought it was Christmas come early. But I was freaking out. I sort of said to myself, Darryl, calm down. Go get a wash. Go get a shave. So I go over to the sink. I start getting a wash. I looked in the mirror and stopped because I didn't recognize my own reflection. It's like, that guy's smiling. He's not just smiling, he's beaming. Then I noticed I didn't just look different, I felt different. Everything had just gone. The hate was gone, the addiction was gone, everything was gone. All I had in me was this big ball of joy trying to break its way out of my chest. If I knew how to dance a jig, I'd have been doing one there and then in the cell. And at that moment, they came and unlocked us. for breakfast. And I stepped out on the landing. The lad next door to me, Duddy, was a bigger nutter than I was. He took one look at me and went, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "I don't know, I'm just happy." I couldn't explain, I couldn't vocalize, I didn't know how to. I thought, I've got to talk to someone that can tell me what's going on. The only person I could think of was the chaplain. So I went straight to the PO, the principal officer on the wing in his office, and I said, "I need an application to see the chaplain." It's the way it works in prison. You want to go to the toilet, put an application in, go in 3 days. It's just the system. So I got my application, and I wrote down everything that had happened the night before, everything that had happened that morning. The PO knew something was wrong. So he read the application for the chaplaincy, and he rang the chaplain. He's like, "Get on the wing now." He's freaking out. So the chaplain came over onto the wing, and I told him everything, absolutely everything. And he sort of paused for a second and just looked straight at me. And I'll never forget the words that came out of his mouth. He said, "The man that went to bed last night is not the same man that's standing here this morning. You're a new creation." As soon as he said those words, I started blubbing. And I'm not talking a little bit sniffly. I'm talking snot flinging, tears flying, wailing. And when I started, he started. So we're both going at it, and then we hugged. So I'm standing on the wing in front of all the lads, bawling my eyes out, hugging a bloke in a frock. So it got their attention. The chaplain said to the PO, "I need to get him over to the chapel. We need to talk some more." The PO's like, "I don't care where you take him, just get him off my wing." Turned back around to the lads who were all eating breakfast, and I didn't know any other way to say it, so I just said it as it is. I said, "Jesus has saved me. No more fighting, no more drugs, no more nothing. If you've got anything of mine, I don't want it back. If you owe me anything, forget about it. I'm done. I'm finished." And it was like a rehearsed Scooby-Doo moment. They all went, "Oh." That was a gamble. When your main currencies have been fear and violence, to stand up and say, "I'm not doing it anymore," that's a big open door for retribution, for someone to come and have a go. And it almost happened 3 days later on the exercise yard. This lad who 3 days before had never tried this, he got right in my face. What I would have normally done was to grab this kid's ears and put his nose right in the back of his skull. But I couldn't. And the words of my granddad, bizarrely, came back to me. Granddad used to say, "It takes a bigger man to walk away." Never understood that. I thought, if they're on the floor bleeding and I'm standing up, I'm bigger. But I knew what he meant. And I started walking away from this kid. All the time, he's chirping on. Every step I got away from him, I just got calmer and calmer and calmer until that same joy hit me again. And I just heard this, not an audible voice, but kind of in my heart and my head at the same time, if that makes sense. And it just said, "You're not that man anymore." At that precise moment, Duddy, the guy I mentioned before, stepped in, grabbed this lad and went, "Listen, you might have changed, but I haven't, so shut your mouth." Duddy later became a Christian. That marks the beginning. All those years ago, some 16 years ago. Ever since that day, I've been living up to my end of the deal. Ever since that day, I've been living, every day is a day borrowed, not a day owed. Every single day, I've been discovering more about how amazing God is, how faithful God is. I'm not just a walking, talking testament to the power of God. I'm a walking, talking testament about the love of God. Because every single day he's had me in his hand. Every single day he's never let me down. Every day is an adventure. Every day I go to bed happy and I wake up smiling regardless of what is going on around me. Everything could be falling apart. The house could be falling down. It doesn't matter. Because I've discovered something that outweighs anything that this world could offer me. Beyond any paycheck, beyond any promotion, beyond any career, beyond anything at all, I've found something that no man can take off me. And that's life. The Bible calls it in abundance. A real fulfillment. I found the peg that fits the hole. Some of the claims that Jesus made are, pretty phenomenal. One of them is Jesus claims to be the life. He really is important to me than the air I'm breathing right now. This body could shut down, pack up right now, right this second. A piano could drop on my head, but it doesn't matter. Because I believe I'm going to heaven. I believe that I'm an eternal being. And this life, the way it is now, is just a temporary part of who I am. And it's a temporary part of life. These are the big, big, big questions that we very rarely take the time to sit down and properly answer. Like, what makes you you? I can't look at you and describe what makes you you. Because what makes you you are your emotions, your loves, your cares, your memories. That's you, that's your soul. And we'll live forever. So when Jesus said, I am the life, the resurrection and the life, which means I am not just life, I'm life eternal. He really did mean it. And if he didn't, I wouldn't be here. Another claim that Jesus made, Jesus claims to be the truth. You'll always have questions in your walk with God. But if Jesus Christ was not exactly who he claimed to be, I would not be alive. For me, it is that simple. I would not physically be here if Jesus were not exactly who he said he is. Because I have tested it, I have tried it, I have put that coat in the bin. He just is who he says he is. But the Alpha will give you an opportunity to see some of the practicalities behind that. Jesus claims to be the way. I said there, trust me, I've tried them all. Okay? I've been down every avenue pretty much known to man. And the only one, like I said, the peg that finally fit, tried money, didn't work. Tried sex, didn't work. Tried drugs, didn't work. Tried alcohol, didn't work. None of them worked. Only when Jesus came into my life did I find what was missing. I was just walking around with polo syndrome. There was something missing, and I didn't really know what it was. But it was the most important thing. And when I found it, everything else, like a giant game of Tetris, just dropped into place. And everything made sense. You don't have to go try them all. You can take my word for it. You don't have to go out there and become a cokehead or become an heroin addict. You don't have to go out there and try it. Trust me. It wears off. It wrecks your life. It's expensive. And addictions can take many, many forms. It might be work. It could even be EastEnders. To me, that's the saddest addiction of all. Gotta get me EastEnders fixed. I hate that program. People say, why don't you like watching EastEnders? Because I'm living in EastEnders. Why would I want to do a whole day's work and then come home and watch it again on telly? I could finish my day. I'm going to get a key ring that has a button that does the drums. Every day I finish work, doof, 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 doof. That's my day. I could sell them scripts. We're going to have some discussion now in groups. I'm going to hand back over to the Alpha team here. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for giving me the time and the honor of being able to talk to you about the things that are really important in my life. As you go through this Alpha course, give yourself the grace that you deserve to ask the questions. There's no stupid questions. Oh, that's not right. They are stupid questions. But no one's going to look down on you for them. All right? Enjoy.